Mark chapter 4, verses 35 through 41. On that day, when evening had come, he said to them, "Let us go across to the other side." And leaving the crowd, they took him with them in the boat, just as he was. And other boats were with him. And a great windstorm arose, and the waves were breaking into the boat, so that the boat was already filling. But he was in the stern, asleep on the cushion. And they woke him and said to him, "Teacher, do you not care that we are perishing?" And he awoke and rebuked the wind and said to the sea, "Peace, be still." And the wind ceased, and there was a great calm. And he said to them, "Why are you so afraid? Have you still no faith?" And they were filled with great fear and said to one another, "Who then is this that even the wind and the sea obey him?" This is the word of the Lord. Please be seated.
Back in September, we said we had a single goal for this year's annual focus on gospel movement in our church, gospel movement in our own lives. And our single goal was this: to learn how to redraw the church. And I showed you a picture that my daughter Leela drew at preschool. She brought it home and I said, "Leela, why does the tree have two trunks?" And she said, "Those aren't trunks, Daddy. Those are legs." I said, "I have a second question, Leela. Why does the tree have legs?" And she said, "Because it wants to give its apples away, Daddy." And we said, we need to learn to redraw the church, to redraw the church with legs, because we have something much more important than apples to give away. We must give away the gospel. We must give away our resources to the poor, neglected, marginalized. We must give away food to the hungry and clothes to the naked. We must give away relationship to those who are lonely and care to those who are sick. We must learn to redraw the church, to redraw the church with legs, to not imagine the church as a building, but to imagine the church as the people that gather in the building and then march out of here wherever we find ourselves on Monday morning and begin giving the fullness of Jesus's gospel away. That was our goal, to learn to redraw the church. And this led us to some studies this past fall. We studied the movement of God's people. We studied the church as the vehicle for God's movement. And during Advent, we looked at the movement of God, that God's movement toward us at Christmas is the basis and foundation for our movement toward the world. As we come to this new year, albeit a week late, inevitably, we will face obstacles to movement, both as a church and as individuals. And so what we want to do is dedicate the next 7 weeks to learning how to move over, move around, or even sometimes move alongside our most common obstacles to God's movement in our lives. We'll start today with the obstacle of circumstances. I remember a time when I faced some difficult circumstances in my life. To that date in my life, these were the most difficult circumstances I'd ever faced. And some of you were here a couple weeks ago on the first of the year, and you got to meet my dad, who is a pastor down in Virginia Beach, and he delivered the sermon here. And I have the privilege of having a wonderful relationship with my dad. He's been a great mentor to me for many years, as long as I can remember. And I was facing these circumstances, and I called him up. I said, "Dad, I'm facing something that to date in my life, I've never faced anything like this. I need to talk to you as soon as possible." And I think he was kind enough to come to Williamsburg the very next day. We sat down at lunch, and I poured my heart out. I said, "Dad, this is what happened, and here's the result, and here's where I am now. And Dad, there's a lot at risk here with these circumstances." I felt like so much of what I cared about, almost everything that I cared about in my life, was put at risk because of these circumstances. And I said, "So Dad, help me." And he looked at me and said, "I wondered when something like this was going to happen to you." He didn't say, "I can't believe it. What do you mean? I've never heard about anything like that in my life. He didn't say, God must be asleep at the wheel. He didn't say, I'm sure you deserve this. He didn't say, wow, what big sin is in your life that this happened? He just simply said, I wondered when something like this was going to happen to you. Because difficult circumstances are a universal experience that we all go through for a variety of reasons, some caused, some brought upon us. And when we encounter these circumstances, I think there are reactions that we all have. And this week, as I was studying, and if you're going through a time of difficult circumstances in your own life, I would say, I could not recommend this book more highly. It's called Walking with God Through Pain and Suffering by Tim Keller. And he outlines three common reactions to our circumstances. And I call these universal reactions to a universal experience. Number one, we can run through our suffering. Number two, we can run from our suffering. Number three, we can lie down in our suffering. When we run through our suffering, it's kind of like we put blinders on and we go, I don't want to learn anything. I don't want to know anything. I don't want to gain anything from this experience. I'm just going to run as fast as I possibly can through this and just get through it. I would call this the gut it out reaction to our suffering and circumstances. We can run from our suffering. I call this the insulate myself approach to suffering. I'm going to make sure I do everything in my power to insulate myself from anything bad that could happen to me in my life. As soon as a relationship gets difficult, I'm going to cut that off. I'm going to go the other way. As soon as I see any kind of crisis on the horizon, I'm going to stockpile cash to make sure that I can, that I'm going to be able to survive through this thing. I'm going to buy a new boat. I'm going to buy a new car to give me pleasure and enjoyment while I'm enduring this. I'm just distracting myself. Sometimes people turn to substances to run from their suffering. I'm going to medicate myself with alcohol or pills or whatever it might be in order to not experience what it is that's going on in my life. I'm going to run from my suffering. And then some people lie down in their suffering and they just let it overwhelm them. They start to sort of bathe in the mud. Instead of moving through it, instead of understanding it, instead of learning from it, they kind of wallow in it. Sometimes this can be clinical, and counseling or psychiatry is something that you might need to seek out. But sometimes we just kind of sit there and want to feel sorry for ourselves. Which reaction do you identify with? Do you run through your suffering, blinders on, gut it out? Do you run from your suffering, insulate yourself, stockpile the toys or the cash to make sure that you're insulated from any bad outcome that could ever happen in your life? Do you lie down in your suffering, kind of wallow a little bit, feel sorry for yourself? Which one do you struggle with? Which one are you currently operating in? I believe as we look at Mark chapter 4 this morning, verses 35 through 41, we're going to see an alternative reaction to our circumstances and our suffering. And this is my prayer for all of us, that whatever our current reaction or our current circumstances are, that it would transform to this. And may our reaction to our circumstances lead us to a recognition of Jesus in our circumstances. May our reaction to our circumstances lead to a recognition of Jesus in our circumstances. And as you look at Mark 4, verses 35 through 41, a familiar story, Jesus calming the storm, you're actually going to see four reactions to this story. The disciples' reaction to the storm, Jesus' reaction to the storm, Jesus' reaction to the disciples, and the disciples' reaction to Jesus. I love this outline of this passage, and I do just want to say that when I worked in student ministries here at the Williamsburg Community Chapel, one of my colleagues used this outline to walk through this passage, and it has always stuck with me. And so I want to use it this morning as we look at this story again. The disciples' reaction to the storm, Jesus' reaction to the storm, Jesus' reaction to the disciples, and the disciples' reaction to Jesus. Number one, the disciples' reaction to the storm. Let me read it to you. Mark 4, 35 to 38. On that day when evening had come, he said to them, "Let us go across to the other side." And leaving the crowd, they took him with them in the boat, just as he was, and other boats were with him. And you can see there are some details here, and you go, what does that mean? What does that mean? And as best I can discern, as I've studied this, these are details put in the story to let you know this is an eyewitness account. Someone that really saw this was here, that Jesus went in the boat just as he was. They didn't stop for dinner. They didn't change clothes. There are other boats around them. Someone that really saw this and experienced this is passing this story on to us. Verse 37. And a great windstorm arose, and the waves were breaking into the boat, so that the boat was already filling. But he was in the stern, asleep on the cushion. And they woke him and said to him, "Teacher, do you not care that we are perishing?" The disciples' reaction to the storm, they lash out at Jesus. They lash out at him. But I want you to take note, they do so without rebuke. They don't receive a rebuke from Jesus, even though they go, "Jesus, come on, man. Don't you care? We are perishing. What is your problem?" The rebuke doesn't go to the disciples. The rebuke actually goes to the storm. The point is this: God can handle your emotions. God can handle your frustration. God can handle your questions. In your deepest, darkest pits, God can handle it. Whatever you want to say, he can take it. In fact, he invites it. His own word invites it and gives us the words to use. I want to invite you to turn to Psalm 88. And the reason I want to invite you to turn there, it will come up on the screen, but if you grab a Bible from the seat in front of you or beside you, you'll be able to see something that I think is important at the end of this passage. Psalm 88 is unique among all of the 150 Psalms we have in our Bible. Not for what it does, but for something it doesn't do. It is the only psalm in the Bible that does not do something. And I'll tell you what that is as we read it. But if you would, open up. It's right in the middle of your Bible. If you hit Proverbs, you've gone a little too far. Go back. If you're in Job or Ecclesiastes, you have to go a little further. But open up to the middle. Find Psalm 188. We'll read verses 1 through 7 and then 13 to 18. It says this: "O Lord God of my salvation, I cry out day and night before you. Let my prayer come before you. Incline your ear to my cry. For my soul is full of troubles. My life draws near to Sheol." And Sheol just means the place where dead people go. He's afraid that he is going to the place where dead people go. "I am counted among those who go down to the pit. I am a man who has no strength, like one set loose among the dead, like the slain that lie in the grave, like those whom you remember no more, for they are cut off from your hand. You have put me in the depths of the pit, in the regions of the dark and deep. Your wrath lies heavy upon me, and you overwhelm me with all your waves." This is someone in difficult circumstances, and difficult probably doesn't do justice to what this person is going through. They feel like they're in a pit, and not just in a pit, they feel like they're in the depths of a pit. And not just the depths of the pit, they feel like that pit that they're in is like the grave. They feel like God's wrath is upon them, like waves are just crashing over them, like they can't even catch a breath, just the waves just continue to come and break over them. And so continue on at verse 13. This is how the psalm ends. And this is why it's unique in the Psalter. But I, O Lord, cry to you. In the morning, my prayer comes before you. O Lord, why do you cast my soul away? Why do you hide your face from me? Afflicted and close to death, from my youth up, I suffer your terrors. I am helpless. Your wrath has swept over me. Your dreadful assaults destroy me. They surround me like a flood all day long. They close in on me together. You have caused my beloved and my friend to shun me. My companions have become darkness. And the reason I wanted you to open up to the actual scriptures, you can see there's a little footnote, and they do this when they have trouble picking one translation over another. You could translate this a couple ways. My companions have become darkness. So there's a little three in the red Bibles. Locate the little three at the bottom of the page, and it says this, or darkness has become my only companion. Period. Amen. End of psalm. Darkness has become my only companion. It's the only psalm out of the 150 psalms we have in our Bible that doesn't have an uptick toward worship at the end, that doesn't say, but you, O Lord, are not far off. My salvation is close at hand. You, O Lord, you are my rock, my steadfast one in times of great trouble. But Lord, I feel your mercy all around me. There's no uptick at the end. You heard Charlotte talk about it. She learned she had to look upward at the end of her, in the midst of her struggle. It's the only psalm that just says, darkness has become my only companion. Period. End it. You see, God is not afraid of your frustrations. He's not afraid of your questions. He's not afraid of you lashing out. He gave us the very words to do it. And I think it's beautiful that God gave us at least one psalm so that we know he can take it, even if we don't feel like worshiping at the end of what we have to say to him. Charlotte also said, common feeling in the midst of suffering and difficult circumstances, I felt God had forsaken me. It's basically what the disciples say in the boat. Teacher, don't you care? Do you not care? We are about to drown. Come on. Are you just going to leave us alone to suffer like this? Have you forsaken us? Not only did God give us the very words to cry out to him in Psalm 88 and other psalms, God can handle your frustrations. God can handle your emotions. God can handle your questions because God has asked them to. If you turn to Mark chapter 15, Jesus on the cross, Mark chapter 15, verse 33 and 34, Jesus cries out a common phrase that Charlotte cried out, that so many of us cry out in the midst of our suffering and circumstances. This is Mark 15, 33 and 34, Jesus on the cross. And when the sixth hour had come, there was darkness over the whole land until the ninth hour. And at the ninth hour, Jesus cried with a loud voice, Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani, which means, my God, why have you forsaken me? And Jesus got these words from the Bible. He's quoting Psalm 22, verse 1. God can handle your questions because God has asked the questions himself. Remonstration, which means forceful protest. Remonstration does not diminish reverence because God wants more than reverence. He wants relationship. And because he wants relationship, he wants dialogue, even if it's difficult dialogue. May our reaction to our circumstances lead us to a recognition of Jesus in our circumstances. The disciples' reaction to the storm is to lash out, but they are not rebuked by Jesus. The storm is rebuked. And that leads us to Jesus' reaction to the storm. This is in verse 39. And when he awoke and rebuked the wind and said to the sea, "Peace, be still." And the wind ceased, and there was a great calm. What is Jesus' reaction to the storm? Jesus has something to say in the midst of our storms. Jesus is not silenced by our storms. He has something to say, and in this circumstance, what he says is, "Peace, be still." And so many of us hear that and we go, how can that be? How can he be saying, "Peace, be still"? Everything is just swirling around me. It feels so chaotic. I can't take it one more second. Well, I would say this. If you want to hear the peace, be still in the midst of your circumstances right now, you need to know that just as creation took place in the midst of chaos and confusion, our recreation often takes place in the midst of chaos and confusion. I'd like to look back at Genesis 1:1 and look at the picture of God creating the world by his very word. And I'd like to look at that, and we look at as God creates the world, ask the question, why would our recreation in Jesus Christ be any different than how God creates the world? And so I'll invite you, it'll come up on the screen or you can turn. This one's pretty easy to find. It's the very first verse of the Bible, Genesis 1:1-3. And as I read this, I'll tell you, most people have a tendency to mentally and emotionally skip over verse 2. We read it like this, Genesis 1:1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And mentally and emotionally, we often skip to verse 3. And God said, "Let there be light." And there was light. It almost sounds, when I read it like that, it almost sounds like I was really reading from the Bible. I wasn't. I skipped verse 2. Let me read the whole thing to you. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Verse 2. The earth was without form and void, and darkness was over the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. And God said, "Let there be light." You see, God creates in the midst of this chaos and this confusion that the Bible calls the deep here. Genesis 1:1 is teaching us that not only did the God create the world out of nothing, but once he created it, here's how he did it. He created it in such a way that there was chaos and darkness and deep, but his Spirit was hovering over it. His Spirit was moving in the midst of the depth, moving in the darkness, moving in the chaos and confusion. Whatever your current circumstances are, hearing Jesus' word of peace and stillness requires that we understand this is how God does it. In the midst of circumstances that we loathe, God uses depths and darkness just like he used it in the first creation to recreate you in him. And when you finally embrace this is actually how God works, this is actually his method, then you'll experience what the disciples experienced. After Jesus said, "Peace, be still," the end of verse 39, what did they experience? It says, and there was a great calm. There was a great calm. If you want to experience that great calm, understand that God often uses depths and darkness, chaos and confusion to create and to recreate us into his image and likeness. May our reaction to our circumstances lead to a recognition of Jesus in our circumstances. Third, Jesus' reaction to the disciples. This is in verse 40. He said to them, "Why are you so afraid? Have you still no faith?" Jesus' reaction to the disciples is to ask two questions. And these questions, I believe, are crucial for us to hear. Why are you so afraid? Do you still have no faith? And this story is actually told in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Three of the four Gospels tell this story. And Luke actually records some additional questions that Jesus asks of the disciples. And I imagine that after this wind and storm, after the storm is calmed, that Jesus and the disciples probably had a lot of discussion. And so Luke records some additional questions. And the question that Luke records is, where is your faith? And I want to ask that this morning, along with the question that Mark records, why are you so afraid? And I want to ask Luke's question, because do you still have no faith seems to apply to people who have yet to put their faith in Jesus. But I believe Jesus is asking a question of all of us. Not, do you still have no faith, as important of a question as that is, but a question that applies to both people who have put their faith in Jesus and people who have yet to put their faith in Jesus. This question applies to us all. Where is your faith? And I want to ask these questions in my own life and show you a little bit of how they work together. Why are you so afraid? Where is your faith? And when you ask the question, why are you so afraid, what you'll see is it actually takes you a few steps to get to the real root cause of the fear in your life. And so instead of why are you afraid, sometimes I think it's helpful to ask, well, what am I afraid of? And in my own life, when I ask the question, what am I afraid of, my answer often comes back to this community, this family of faith, this church body. What am I afraid of? I'm afraid that I'm going to make a decision that hurts this body. I'm afraid that there's going to be a leadership move that I think is important to make, and in the end, it's going to be the wrong decision, and it's going to damage this community. When I get real honest with myself, I worry about that, probably to a level that is not indicative of me having full faith and trust, and this is Jesus' church. You see, the reason I think I get there is a few things. One, I look at my role as a steward over something, not as an owner of something. A steward over something, not as an owner of something. You see, I didn't start this church. This church was thriving before I was even born. This church has touched countless lives in this community while I was still in grade school. And I believe this church has such potential to impact the world. When I step back and think about doing something or making a mistake in a decision that would harm it, it just crushes me. I want to be a good steward over what God has asked me to be a steward over at this point in my life. And so that's what I'm afraid of, but then you have to go, okay, well, what would happen? What would happen if you made some catastrophically terrible decision and tanked things? And this is significant enough fear in my life that I actually have a coach and a counselor that I talk to about these things. So I share this. He says to me, well, what would happen? Let's just say that was possible. Now, it's probably a stable enough church that it'd probably take a few decisions, not just one. But let's just go down this road with you, Travis. What would happen? I'm like, well, people would maybe need to go to other churches. He'll say, well, do other churches exist? Yeah, they do. So would that stop people from being able to understand who Jesus is? Know him? Love him? Well, no, it wouldn't. So what really is the issue? If it wouldn't stop people from worshiping Jesus, what's really the problem? And I paused and I thought about it. Said, well, if people had to go to other churches because of something that I had done, I would feel like I let people down. And he said, that's it. That's what you're afraid of. That's the core issue. You actually are not afraid of making a dumb decision. You're really afraid of letting people down. And that's what leads to the next question, which is, where is your faith? If you're afraid of letting people down, and so you're making sure that you do everything you can and just trying to perform, where is your faith then? Well, I guess my faith then would be in my performance. I guess my faith then would be in my decision-making abilities. I guess my faith then would be in my leadership. Why are you so afraid? Where is your faith? Start asking those questions and start asking, well, what am I afraid of? And what would then happen? And get to the core issue and see, where is it that you're really lacking trust? And in what are you actually putting your trust other than Jesus? See, the other day we were having our Friday prayer time. We pray in this room every Friday morning from 8:15 to 8:45. And a different person leads it every week. And just a couple weeks ago, someone led it, and I asked their permission to share this, and they said, here we are on Friday morning, and I'll introduce myself for Friday morning, but I want to tell you how I'm going to introduce myself at Celebrate Recovery on Friday evening. See, Celebrate Recovery is our ministry for people that have hurts, habits, and hang-ups that often stem from addictive behaviors or becoming addicted to substances or other things in this world. And he said, how I'll have to introduce myself tonight is, my name is so-and-so, and I'm an alcoholic who struggles with dishonesty and low self-esteem. It just blew me away. I just stepped back and I thought, what an honest moment. And I'll tell you, we had the best prayer time we've had all year that Friday morning. Best by far. You could just feel God's Spirit working on our hearts in the room. And I believe it was catalyzed by the honesty and vulnerability of that person, willing to lay it all out there before God and say, this is who I am really. I came across a quote. I incorporated it into the sermon this morning because I got it at small group last night, and I loved it from a pastor that I really love. His name is John Ortberg, and he said this, prayer dies when we pretend. Prayer dies when we pretend. And so I want to say one more time to these questions that Jesus asked the disciples, will you honestly answer Jesus's question? Will you answer Jesus's questions honestly? Because prayer will die if you pretend. Jesus's reaction to the disciples calls us to a ruthless level of honesty about the nature of our anxiety surrounding our circumstances. So why are you so afraid? And where is your faith? May our reaction to our circumstances lead to a recognition of Jesus in our circumstances. Finally, the disciples' reaction to Jesus. This is in verse 41. And they were filled with great fear and said to one another, who then is this that even the wind and the sea obey him? This final reaction in the story leads us to the heart of why Mark has given us this account of Jesus calming the storm. That our reaction to our circumstances might lead to a recognition of Jesus in our circumstances. Look at verses 40 and 41. Notice in verse 40, Jesus says, why were you so afraid of what? Afraid of the storm. But verse 41 reveals that they were filled with great fear regarding what Jesus had done. So they were afraid of the storm, but they were filled with great fear about what Jesus had done. And the original language that Mark is writing in here, it just puts it so beautifully, and we can see it very clearly even in our English language from the Greek to the English. It's phobos versus megaphobos. So phobos, which is where we get our word phobia from, I have a phobia or a fear, they are phobos of the storm. They're fearful, they're afraid of the storm, but they're mega phobos of Jesus and his power. There's an author named James Edwards that I read this week on this story, and he puts this very eloquently. He says this, Ironically, the terror of the disciples at what Jesus has done exceeds their initial fear of the storm. The presence of the supernatural is more frightening to humanity than the most destructive of natural disasters. Jesus is still a stranger to his own followers, for they are better able to handle the possibility of their own death than the possibility of the presence of God among them. Ponder that. They are better able to handle the possibility of their own death than the possibility of the presence of God among them. May our reaction to our circumstances lead us to a recognition of our circumstances. Recognition of Jesus in our circumstances. And so here's our point of application. It's the whole reason Mark wrote this story. It's the question right at the end. Who is this? Who is this? It's the whole reason Mark wrote the story. So we would ask that same question that the disciples asked. Who is this? I went to visit someone in the hospital the other day, someone I would invite all of us to pray for. His name is Dan Roper. He was a former chairman of the elders here at the chapel. He has given back to this family of faith in countless ways, countless hours, and just our church has been affected by him. Whether you know him or not, he has been a great blessing to this community of believers. And he was in a life or death infection situation around his heart, and he had to go into a surgery, not knowing whether he would come out living or dying. And he came through the surgery, but he was still in great danger of this surgery not actually being successful and under heavy sedation. So I couldn't go in to actually see him. He had to be in a total sterile environment, but I was able to visit with the family. And this was actually my second visit seeing the family. They have four girls, so I have a great kinship and connection with them. And so there's Dan's wife, Kathy, and their four daughters. And they are there just taking up a corner of the family waiting room at the hospital. And they have another person sitting right in the middle of them. And again, this is the second time I went to visit them. And they were chatting it up with this person. They were sharing all the food that they had been brought with this person. So I thought, okay, here's an aunt, here's a relative, maybe one of Kathy's sisters, someone I just haven't met. So as I was talking to the family, I finally said, hey, I just want to meet you. I'm Travis, and I'm one of the pastors at the church where the Ropers attend. And I said, how do you know the Ropers, aunt? Sister, you know, cousin, what? And she goes, I'm just Suzette that's been sitting in the waiting room by myself during my husband's surgery. And they saw that I was alone over in the corner and they asked me to come sit with them. And I just can't believe food keeps showing up. People keep showing up. I haven't prayed in a long time and people keep coming and asking to pray. I said, Suzette, I'll pray for you. I'll tell the whole church to pray for you. She just is crying. What is this place? What is this community that you're part of? Who is this God that you believe in, that now I've been enveloped in the darkest hour of my life, not knowing if my husband, Tony, is gonna come through this. And all of a sudden, I'm being lifted up and comforted by people who are in their darkest hour. Who is this? He's the one who uses, he is the one who is powerful enough to use our storms to calm other people's storms. Who is this? He's the one who calls us in the first place to go to the other side of the lake. People don't notice that in the story. Whose idea was it to go to the other side of the lake? Jesus' idea. Because on the other side of the lake, they're going to land in Gentile territory. And the gospel is going to go forth to new people. Who is this? He's the one who calls out, peace, be still in the midst of the chaos. Who is this? He's the one who's with us in the boat. The disciples say, don't you care? He obviously cares. He's in the boat. He cares. Who is this? He's the one who's in your circumstances right now with you. Who is this? He is the one who himself cried out, my God, why have you forsaken me? So we might be able to cry out, my God, how you have saved me. That's who this is. Creation recognizes the voice of their creator. He is the creator God among them. And I want to invite Alex and the band up to help us contemplate this reality. Because if you have never asked this question, who is this? I'd invite you to ask it now. And to consider what you read here in Mark chapter 4 as your guide to answering that question, who is this? And maybe ask the question, where have I put my faith? And would my faith be better put in Jesus? That can be done right now. The song we'll sing is called Wonderful, Merciful Savior. Each lyric in this song is a great answer to the question, who is this? Allow the band to sing it over you as you ask that question, believing and trusting that our reaction to our circumstances will ultimately lead to a recognition of Jesus in our circumstances.